All roads of the Illuminati conspiracy theory lead to wealth. This includes keeping you poor financially, mentally, and physically. The most important thing you can do to overcome the oppression of the control system is to establish the security for yourself and your family and be financially self-sufficient. But how do you do that? There's a million influencers and content creators out there promising you this financial freedom, but today's guest is the real deal. He's an old school cowboy. He's been to hell and back, and I personally know and trust this guy so much. I wanted him to share some of his story with you because I want you to be prepared for whatever you want your future to look like. Today's guest is Billy Peterson, and he's the president and owner of Peterson Wealth Services. He holds CFP and CDFA designations and has been a licensed financial advisor since 1997, selected to Forbes Best in State Wealth Advisor 5 times. His firm manages $500 million for clients all over the country. He's also a world champion jockey, and he's got an amazing life story that's truly inspirational that he's going to share with us. My name is Isaac Weitzop. You're listening to the Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture Podcast, where we take rational looks at occult symbolism and entertainment, as well as conspiracy theories, to see if there's any truth behind them. I've been researching these topics full-time since 2011 and podcasting for over a decade, so join me as we peer behind the curtains of the financial world. Now, today's show is important because I want you to improve your lives in 2024. While everyone else is going to be eating up black pills, worried about the election, you're going to join me in taking positive steps forward, because ultimately you have to take care of yourself regardless of all of this distraction going on in the circus sideshows everywhere, okay? We're going to talk to Billy today about this. We're going to talk about his path from, you know, he had major health issues as a baby and overcame this to become a world champion jockey, and he will tell us how dangerous that profession truly is. I mean, these guys are riding on these horses doing 45, 50 miles an hour. And if a leg blows out on that horse, I mean, that's like flying out of a windshield on the highway. It's insane. And he's going to talk about the important, you know, this is a concept in the occult, overcoming fear. And we talk about Dune, you know, I talk about the Dune reference of fear being the little death. And Billy, he literally faced death and he rode straight through it. Unlike these fake Freemasons, these skull and bones just lying in coffins acting like it. No, he really did it. And we're going to talk about the importance of the mind, which ironically, he's got the same view that I take, that I wrote about in my alien books. Thoughts become beliefs, become reality. I mean, he almost echoed the same exact mantra, which I thought was cool. I don't think he knows that. I don't think he's read my alien books. We're going to get his take on law of attraction. Can that idea be applied to building wealth? Hint, it can. Then we're going to get into his forte, the state of the financial market, inflation, CPI data, and how that could be manipulated. The crypto market, he doesn't like cryptos. You know, but Billy, he's an old school financial guy. I wouldn't expect him to like cryptos. So we kind of get into that a little bit. We'll talk about the tools you need in order to be self-sufficient. And he tells us his thoughts on the Federal Reserve. Right? Hot topic in the conspiracy world, the pandemic, and, you know, if inflation's really going down, the squeeze and destruction of the middle class, and, you know, there's going to be some investment strategy talk, and we're going to discuss his new book. So without further delay, here's our conversation with Billy Peterson. And while you're listening, I want you to get into the show notes, because I want you to follow him, check out his podcast. I was on there in February. You can listen to those episodes. I listen to his episodes because they're good. They're easy to understand, and it gets you into the financial information without going too deep and into the nerd stuff. So check out his social media, his book on Amazon, and his podcast. Let's go. For me, I feel like there are portals or gateways that lead one into the conspiracy world. And for me, health was one of those things, you know, understanding how our entire system here in America is filled with various health pitfalls, from corporate America spiking the food with poisonous additives and the FDA sometimes looking the other way because of corporate lobbyists and things like that. But another gateway for me is the world of finances, because that's kind of what this is all about, in terms of occultism and various theories about the elites. It's all about accumulating wealth, which some would describe as an alchemical process. And some would even say that debt is, in a way, a form of slavery, and that could have some truth to it. And I want our audience, this year I'm pushing a more self-help route, And I want our audience to start making the moves needed to become more financially independent. So I brought on a guest who knows how to do it. He's gone down the road. I'm very excited to be joined by a true Renaissance man. He's honestly one of the most impressive human beings I think I've ever had the privilege to meet. He's a champion horse jockey, author of two books, teaches a financial literacy boot camp at Weber State University, started his own financial management company, Peterson Wealth Services, and now he's a podcaster for the Harnessing Your Wealth podcast. Today, we're joined by Billy Peterson. Welcome to the show, Billy.
Isaac, I'm super happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to start off with something fun. I'm gushing about Billy. He doesn't know this, but I admire him. I've read his book, his first book. His second one isn't out yet. I will read it when it comes out. I know Billy personally, and one of the unexpected impacts Billy has had on my life is that he got me to start listening to country music, right? And I talked to his son Cade about this just yesterday, because some time ago Cade was giving me grief. We were just kind of busting each other up a little bit because I'm a hip-hop guy, and he asked me if I even knew who Morgan Wallen was, and I didn't know. I was like, no, I don't. And because, you know, growing up and all this stuff, I always thought country music is for like
hillbillies,
wannabe hillbillies, and you know, there's no such thing as real cowboys anymore. And to be fair, that's kind of how rap is for me. I'm not a drug dealer. I don't participate in any of the things they talk about, but I enjoy it, right? So it's like watching Scarface for me, you know. And then I read Billy's book, his first book, Harnessing Your Wealth, and I thought, man, these guys, they're really about the values that I hear about in country music and the stereotypes of country music. And I respect that. And, you know, it wore me down. And I eventually kind of listened to some Chris Stapleton and Morgan Wallen. And, now I got a country playlist. So, you know, thanks for that too, Billy.
Heck yeah. It's called The Code of the West, Isaac. I mean, there's a lot of value in that if you study it. And I grew up that way, and I hold those principles pretty close to my heart. I'm not a big fan of rap. I've got to be honest. Now, I have listened to Eminem occasionally. I think the guy's pretty talented, but I listen to some of these songs nowadays, and I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed what they're saying, and it's become so normalized that it's just the language that they use, and there's, you know, it's kind of like painting a picture of, wow. I mean, this is what normal society now. What we're doing is, you know, whatever abusive stuff or stripping down and doing all these crazy things. I don't know. I can't get on board with it, man.
I agree with you. I was born and raised into that. So like for me, it's always been entertaining, and it reminds me of sort of, you know, party days and being young and foolish. But as I get older, I kind of see how it does have a detrimental effect. And, you know, me and my wife, Josie Wisehop, we were talking about how the state of music is, you know, in the 90s and the 80s, we had a mixture. There was like some hip hop stuff, but then there was a lot of love and pop. And nowadays there's not a lot of love music. And that's what I like about the country. It's like, it kind of calms me, bring it back. I want to slow dance with my girl when I listen to it, that kind of stuff. So anyway,
you're coming in, man. Welcome to the club.
It's pulling me in. But I want to start out with, I want to introduce you to the audience, because you've got a fascinating background. I want to take just, you know, 5-10 minutes or so, before we get into some real talk about investments and the state of affairs and why it's important and all those things. I'd like to have you talk about your journey, because you have a fascinating story that you talk about in your first book, and it's, you know, you were the country's top quarter jockey in the 90s, and your experience of it was wild. It had highs, lows. Some of it looked miserable, from the dieting to these horrifically dangerous accidents. And one last thing, and I'm going to turn it over to you for a while. When it comes, because people are probably thinking, man, this is an occult symbolism podcast. Why are we talking about finances? In your book, you talk about the experience of being a jockey, and in there you say fear equals demise. And that's a concept I see oftentimes in the occult, specifically in the recent Dune movies. They have a thing, and they say fear is the little death. And this is a sort of idea in occult rituals of facing death, and you come through the other side a better, stronger person. And, you know, I know you personally, and you're a very tough individual, and you've overcome some serious things, you know, and you're fit and tough as nails. So I think your journey is very important to understand how you came to be where you're at today. So if you don't mind kind of briefly going through your history.
You bet. So for everyone out there, thanks for listening. And I would say stories are the way we all relate to one another. And I like to share stories. That's how I talk to people. And that's also how I write in my books. I have a lot of stories to share and things that have happened to me in my life and, you know, adversity. I think all of us are dealt some setbacks from time to time. I don't think any of us escape life unscathed completely. There's going to be some challenges, sometimes monumental challenges that we have to figure out how to overcome and stand up. And I always say, get back on the horse. If you can't find a way to get back in the saddle, you're never going to rise to the level that you could potentially achieve. And that's been my mantra, my motto, my whole life, is I've been thrown from horses, literally thrown more times than I can count. Accidents, injuries, broken bones, layups, you know, abandonment when I was a kid. From the time I was 3 years old, I was born with a genetic deformity. My legs were so severely bowed, the doctors didn't know that I'd ever really be able to walk, get around. But it's a genetic condition. It's a X-linked hypophosphatemia problem. It's called rickets. And it runs in my family, as mentioned. It passes from the females to the males through the X chromosome. And I received that X chromosome from my mother. And so as I started to stand, I didn't have the strength in my bones to absorb that weight. And my legs just severely bowed. I mean, significant deformity. Anyone would look at me, and they just started calling me Bow-Legged Billy. That was my nickname. My parents didn't have enough money to really give me the proper medical care, put me in a hospital. And at the time, the only way doctors knew how to help that problem was to cut the bones, and they cut my femurs in half. I went down to Shriners, and this is where I talk about abandonment, because I was forced to be left there. I was left at the Salt Lake City Shriners Hospital for 3 months. Basically, I was there for a long time. And at 3 years old, when you're left somewhere like that in a ward full of kids, all in the same big room, and you're seeing so many kids who are burned severely across their whole body, or who have no arms, or who are unable to move, it was traumatizing. And we talk about traumas a lot, and I use the term ACEs in my new book, and that stands for adverse childhood experiences. And those have such a monumental impact on our future health. So I'll get into all that maybe in a minute. But what happened to me was, with this surgery, it stunted my growth. My family is all very tall. And you mentioned Cade, my son, he's 6 feet tall. My cousins, my dad, my sister even towers over me, but it stunted my growth. They told me I would have been 6 feet tall. I grew to a maximum height of 5'6" based on that. Well, that's one of those things that were dealt with in life, challenges, whatever you want to call it, but I turned it into an opportunity. I made the best of it, and that allowed me, with my short stature, to pursue a career as a racehorse jockey. And I started doing that. I started exercising horses when I was 12, 13 years old, starting riding in races when I was 14 and 15. And things started to compound after that. And it really took off. That became my whole passion in life. I mean, I kind of stopped doing anything associated with my friends in high school. I was all in on being a jockey. I wanted to ride the best. I wanted to be the best. I never gave up that dream. And in quarter horse racing, there's a big race called the All-American Futurity. So Isaac, this is kind of it's the equivalent of the Kentucky Derby, for those who understand thoroughbred racing. And it's equivalent of the Super Bowl or the World Series or whatever you want to call, you know, whatever sport you want to pick, but it's the epitome of this sport. The All-American is a $3 million race, but you have to whittle it down to the top 10 qualifiers. And to start out, there are maybe 300 or more horses who are entered into the time trials, kind of like a qualification process. The time trials are where They run 2 weeks prior to the final race. And my first year at Rio Doso, and this is fast forward, and I'm just kind of going through this quickly, but it was always my dream to win the All-American. And I got to that stage in 1994 and qualified a horse. I was the youngest jockey to ever qualify a horse to this race. We get to the final gate, ESPN crews are there, my family, everyone's there for the race. And greatest moment of my life. Unbeknownst to me, this horse had suffered an injury during the time trials that the trainer didn't let on. I didn't know about, no one really knew about other than the trainer and the owner and the veterinarian. What they did was they blocked this horse's leg. So they injected him with a numbing medication. He couldn't feel anything in his legs. The race gets underway. About 300 yards into the 440-yard race, the horse breaks his right knee. His knee breaks in half. And, you know, when you're going that fast, 45 miles an hour down a straightaway, there's no way the horse is going to stay up, be able to pull himself up. And goes, I mean, instantly to the ground and throws me. And I don't know how many times I rolled. But most of the time in an injury like that or in an accident like that, the jockey is suffered a severe injury and many times death, because it's such a violent force throwing you to the ground. It usually breaks a neck or a spine or some multiple bones. For me, by the grace of God, I was able to turn and roll and not suffer any major consequential damage to my body other than to my mind. And that's where the fear we talked about earlier started creeping in. From that, laying in the dirt, the Rio Doso straightaway, like my dreams. I spent my whole life up to that point thinking about that race and being in that race. And that's the ending. That was my ending. And it was another one of those traumatizing moments that I had to figure out if I had what it takes to get back in the saddle again, do it again, stay with this dream. And I know, you know, if anybody's read my book, they will know that I did make it back. And the following year, again, a magical manifestation, miracle, connecting to the universe, whatever you want to call it. The horse came into my life that no one had ever heard of, and a no-name horse with no breeding. The owners were the first time ever purchasing a racehorse, a black couple from Odessa, Texas, who'd never been involved in horse racing. I mean, the story is profound, but how it all developed and how it came to be, and then for the trainer to ask me to ride the horse, even after he'd ran two times unsuccessfully, and then that came to me. And the story from there and what this horse went on to be, he become the world champion that year. And one of the fastest racehorses ever to race. And I was given that opportunity to come back and win the All-American the next year. So the articles were all about tragedy to triumph and what I went through and how I got back to that stage, which is very rare, and was able to win that race the next year. It was pretty amazing.
Was that horse the one named Win a Lot of Cash?
Yep.
Wow. That's him. Okay. Yeah, because that was something I found interesting in your book, was you talk about the mind being the beginning and the end. And, you know, and it's an interesting concept. The idea is that physical manifestations start in the mind in a way. And, you know, I've read a book, man, I don't remember the title of it. My friend put me onto this book. It's kind of one of those woo-woo, you know, how to manifest wealth, how to manifest money, and not investing. It means like getting, you know, meditating and sort of channeling an energy of acceptance into these things. And, you know, I read half of it and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I don't know if it's true or not, but I mean, doesn't it seem, you work with people of all income levels, and do you think there's something to that, like a law of attraction for people that seem to be more receptive to wealth coming in, and it works? Do you think there's something to that?
Well, if you had asked me that question maybe 10 years ago, I'd have probably scoffed. But from what I've learned, and mostly I learned as a result of the health issues that I suffered for many years, but having found the way across that river, and I call it the river of pain, chronic pain, illness, disease, just poor health. And now to a point where you understand how it all manifests, how it comes to be. You understand that the mind is the most powerful functioning organism on the planet, or whatever we want to refer to it as. It's amazing what the mind can do, and specifically the subconscious mind, because we're not conscious of the things that are going on. And this has to do with health, it has to do with wealth, has to do with the miracles that are coming every day to those of us who can tap into that frequency. So no, it's not unreal. It's not fake. It's 100% out there. And I'm not suggesting people just sit back and manifest winning the lottery and, you know, wait, do nothing. There has to be some level of effort, but you have to connect to the future that you want as if it's already happened, as if it's there. So you're living in that reality already. You can't wait for it. You can't try to control the outcome of what it's going to look like exactly. You just have to say, this is what I want. This is what I'm going to have. This is what I already have. So that's where it goes back to the law of attractions. Like attracts like. And if you are thinking about, constantly thinking about your abundance and what you have and what you're grateful for, guess what? More of the same comes to you. More of the same. But if, on the other hand, you're one of those type of people who are always miserable, always victimizing yourself, always looking at what you don't have, you've done the same. You've added more to your pain, because more will be coming. And you have to find a way to snap out of that and get back to consciously knowing how you're thinking. Now, we go kind of this, you know, habitual thinking, sometimes like you're driving, just show up. You don't even know. You don't even remember the drive. So we get these not quite subconscious level thinking, but we're not really conscious of what we're thinking most times. And that's where a lot of times the fear comes in, the anger. You know, there's a great doctor who started a movement with chronic pain and how to, why it manifests, named Dr. John Sarno. And he was one of the pioneers in this work. And he talked about subconscious rage, that most of us have buried rage that we aren't even aware of. And we're really upset about certain things that are going on, but we're too afraid to bring it to light because of the perception of what's socially acceptable. We can't get mad. We can't throw a tantrum like a little kid. We have to, you know, grin and bear it type thing. But it makes us very furious subconsciously. And that's where you harbor too much of this tension. Guess what's coming? Something's got to be released, and there's going to be some sort of a illness, pain condition, chronic pain, disease. And that's where the health issues, I mean, I'm really big on that. And that's a large conversation. Yeah. And for your audience, a lot of the conspiracy things, it's huge, because the conflicts of interest are massive within the healthcare industry. The cover-ups, the things that they tell us we need, the things that we continually seek and go after, the quick fixes, the drugs, the surgeries, the manipulations, but they'll never get us completely healed. They'll never get us out. We're just doing symptom management.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's what seems like, you know, one recurring theme is that, and I think everyone sees this and experiences it, so they believe it, is the idea that our social programming, the mainstream media, the news, and it might be just the nature of the business, you know, with that sort of it bleeds, it leads kind of idea, that we're drawn to all this sort of negative news, and it puts you in a negative mindset or a fearful mindset. And, you know, me as a conspiracy guy and my crew, we're just as guilty, hell, if not more guilty sometimes of pushing that stuff too. You know, yeah. The eclipse was a big one where every conspiracy theorist, myself included, discussed all these different things going on. We're like, oh my God, CERN's going to fire up and NASA shooting rockets into the moon, and we don't know what's going to happen. It could be the government takeover where, you know, you got to have food and water because the National Guard, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know what the answer is, because we can't, you know, bury our heads in the sand, but I do think there's something to letting it affect you. You know, because I think some people can handle more negative stuff than others, but I think that it's interesting, is all I'll say about that, is how all these things do seem connected. And if you understood all these things and you wanted to keep people in a negative, fear-based mindset, it's pretty easy to do in our modern society.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to me what we tend to allow and what we tend to believe and agree with. It's just habit. It's the way we do things, and habits are started just by simple thought alone. You know, the thinking, what we put into our head, what we allow to be there, we continually repeat that thought, and then it becomes a belief. And then the belief, if we start convincing ourselves that that's correct, and that becomes habit, and then that habit becomes our personality. Mm. Personality becomes our personal reality. It's really what our life becomes, traces all the way back to just thought alone. If you think that you're great, if you think that you suck, you're right either way. And that's the thing people forget. All this stuff goes back to wealth, health, everything in your life. You know, it's what you think, what you believe. It's, do you need to depend on something else to have the things you want? If you're always giving away your freedom, you know, I don't think you're ever going to be able to get to the point where you have the ability to do it on your own. You know, obviously you never trust yourself or your own instincts. Many years ago, people relied on themselves more than they do today. And I think it's unfortunate because we've allowed way too many of our freedoms to be taken over.
Right. Yeah. I actually agree with that. One of my, I call him my red pill daddy, Bill Cooper, was an old school conspiracy theorist guy. And one of his ideas was that the problem with socialism, you know, philosophically with socialism, it sounds good on paper. It's like, we're going to help people out that, you know, for whatever reason, they got the short stick and like they need a hand. And like, you know, we want everyone to do well in this country and we don't want anyone living on the streets and in poverty and yada, yada, yada. And he said, you know, the issue with socialism is that if you become too reliant on someone to feed, you know, it's like that old Christ parable of teaching a man to fish kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he said the issue with that becomes people who are easily controlled, because now you're, you know, the place you depend on for your Maslow's pyramid of food, shelter, water, all that, the people who you now rely on can now control you. And, you know, in the conspiracy world, that's ultimately what we think is happening, is they want full control. So my question would be for you, and we don't have enough time to go mega deep into it, and I know you put on presentations and financial literacy boot camps. How does one start down this journey? And this isn't for the advanced day trader or nothing like that. How does someone who's out there just kind of going through their 9-to-5, you know, maybe they got a few bucks left over at the end of the month, what's the key concepts you would want to, you know, convey to them, or what's the best way to get this done that you can eventually save up for a retirement? Should people be listening to some of these more modern topics of buying cryptos and NFTs, or a lot of people in the conspiracy world are like, you got to buy gold because gold's the next thing and the US dollar is going to crash. How do we start down this path here?
There's a lot going on with that. And it's a good question. It's probably the best question. And everyone wants an answer that's going to get them to the glory land, promised land quickly. It's just like, hey, I'm sick. Give me a pill. I'm in pain. Oh. Give me a pill. And now they think, well, I need to retire. I want to be rich. Give me the answer. I mean, just, you know, write it down. Get instruction manual here. Now I want to find that result quickly. And so that's why I think there's so many people turning to that crypto deal, because it is impacting people, and the especially the early investors, let's call them, very rapidly. And so on paper anyway, they're starting to show that they have massive wealth. And that's why so many people are getting involved in it. And, you know, if I'm true to my colors, and you know this about me, I am not a believer in crypto world. I am very much against it, to be honest. I don't agree with that as an investment. I'm not suggesting that it's not a tool. and it couldn't be used for as a currency for certain things. I understand very kind of modestly the technology behind it, so the blockchain concept and why it was became mainstream, let's say. However, to use it as an investment is nothing more than speculation. It's basically saying, I'm going to take baseball cards that are watermarked, and that's going to be our new investment of choice. That's going to be our new way we look at things or trade things. So that's not my recommendation at all. I think investing takes time. The best day to start investing, best time, is yesterday. The second best time is today. And that's where most people trip. They don't start. That's the biggest problem I see with folks, is they just put it off. It's always going to be tomorrow, and I can't afford it right now. I started investing when I was 14 years old. I really didn't know what I was doing, but I took the advice of a local guy that I met at the coffee shop who spent enough time, had enough interest, and told me, as I was making some decent money for a kid my age then, this is what you need to do. Putting it in the bank is not going to get you anywhere other than just somewhere to hold it. Might as well be a coffee can, but the bank is going to do it for you, and they're going to make some money on it. So I realized, hey, I don't want to have the bank making money on my money. I want to make money on my money. So I figured out the investing thing. It's just you start putting it away. You put it away in stocks. Stocks are businesses. A lot of clients and even friends who maybe come into some money and they say, man, I want to start a business. I want to open a franchise. And I say, okay, well, that might be well and good, but what if you did just a passive investment with this very exact same idea, where you don't have to come up with all that money, borrow it, have all the headaches of employees, insurance, dealing with all the suppliers and marketing, etc. What if you just bought passively into a business that's already established? Well, can I do that? Yeah, you can do that. It's called investing in the stock market. You can buy and sell stock any day of the week. But this is where I want people to understand, is don't look at investing as something that you have to do. That's like an activity. You have to sit down and look at this every day and decide if I want to continue to hold this business or not. Just this last week, I've had a number of clients call me based on the situation brewing in Iran with Israel and what's going on. Hey, we're going to have war. Is this nuclear war? Is this World War III? Why the hell are we going into war? What are we going to do about it? Stocks are going down. Should we sell? Well, I say, all right, let's say, for example, you own a hardware store. All right. Or you own a grocery store, and you've owned this business for 30 years, and you've done well, and you know what you're doing with the business. Now, do you wake up and see that Iran is potentially going to invade Israel and decide you're going to sell that business? Is that going to be your ultimate decision? That's as much loyalty you have to your business? They all say no. Well, that's the exact same thing. If you own Home Depot or Costco or Apple or Amazon or any other company that we want to talk about in your portfolio, why would you want to just sell those shares? Because maybe other people have a short fuse and they react, psychologically panic, want to sell their shares. They want to dump them. And that's the easiest thing in the world to do, because stocks are so liquid. You can buy and sell them any given moment, any day of the week that the market is open. Buy and sell. And that's where the traders, I think, make this thing so hysterical and turn it into a circus. You turn on CNBC and you listen to Jim Cramer. The guy's a fool. And I'll tell that to him to his face. He's a fool. He's turned us into a circus.
Yeah, I follow a guy. He's called, a person who has an account called Inverse Jim Cramer. And they boast about buying and selling the opposite of whatever Jim Cramer says. And it does well.
Yeah, it makes sense. Buy. I mean, you know, that's not how you react. It's, again, become a business owner, because that's who you are. That's what you are. When you buy shares in a stock, you are a business owner. You actually own the company. Doesn't mean you want it. It's not like sitting at a craps table where you're throwing around dice and all of a sudden, oh, crapped out. We're sevened out. All the money's gone. That doesn't happen. And people need to understand that the only way you're going to lose all your money in the market is if those companies go bankrupt. And so if Apple and Costco and Home Depot and Exxon Mobil and, you know, just go down the line, if all those companies somehow went bankrupt, I would submit to you that we have way bigger problems than those companies and your money, because we're probably on the brink of absolute destruction. And then you just need your guns and your ammo. I mean, really, what do you need at that point? I don't know.
If
money is not worth anything, what does it matter? So it's never happened in the history of the markets. The market is a term that I don't even like to use, because people think that that's something, again, we're going somewhere every day and we have to decide, what are we going to do when we get to the market? The market's just a place where other people can go to buy and sell. And it may be a place where you go occasionally if you want to add to your investments. I don't ever say I want to go to the market and sell. I may decide I want to trim back for certain reasons. If I have, you know, a necessary, if I'm retired and, hey, every month I have a cash flow need, I'll be trimming back. But if I'm younger and I'm building for my retirement 20, 30, 40 years down the road, I want prices to be going down. That's when you make your returns, is when they're down. So you can't get scared when other people are scared. Mm-hmm. Best strategy is do the opposite of what everyone else is doing. And you remember the meme stock craze a few years ago.
You know, Billy, I've fallen victim to every single one of these things. And let me backtrack for 2 seconds here, because I talk about cryptos because I do buy and sell cryptos still to this day. And I've been through a lot of the ups and downs. I've had many times, especially the last couple of years, where I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? What am I doing? I would give it all to just put it into a stock ETF instead of Bitcoin and Ethereum stuff. But the interesting points you make, and these are all in your book, like you talk about the emotions in investing and a lot of the concepts you talk about. Years ago, I had a friend who knows a very extremely wealthy guy, and I keep nudging my friend. I'm like, you got to talk to him. How do we get rich, man? I want to be rich like him. And he said, okay, you're going to read a bunch of books. The first one is Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. And I look it up and I'm like, this is a book from like 1991 or something, dude. Why am I reading this? Yeah. And he's like, no, the concepts are the same. And all the things you just said, and you saved, I could have listened to the last 10 minutes of what you said and not had to read the whole book. That's basically what Peter Lynch is saying. And, you know, so this is all, to me, vetted stuff. And I don't know if we covered it yet. You're a professional, right? Like you own, what are your credentials for people who are like, why should I listen to this Billy guy? Who is Billy? Like you own a financial, I don't know, what do you call it?
Advisory? Yeah, I own a financial advisory firm. We're registered with the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. I've been an investment advisor for 28 years. And yeah, I speak differently than some. I'm not the polished, slick-haired guy, New Yorker. I grew up on a farm.
Hey, easy with the East Coast slander.
You know, hey, no offense. You're a guy I can relate to, but some of those guys I worked with for years on the Wall Street side, I wouldn't trust them with anything.
Yeah, it's like the guys you see in The Wolf of Wall Street, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of that character.
Oh
right?
Yeah, that they're characters, and but that stuff was happening a lot. I mean, I was seeing that. I was seeing kind of these underhanded investment recommendations. I started out in the firm Payne Weber, Long Beach, California, in 1997. So I started studying for the exam. Call it the Series 7 exam in 1996 when I was still a jockey. So I'm this 110-pound guy going into the brokerage firm during the day and studying to become an advisor. I really wanted that because I had this passion about investing time. I learned about it when I was 14. Other people in the racetrack started asking me, how do I get investing? Because I was investing and it wasn't like I was trading. I don't want anybody to take that perception like I'm trading. I'm investing regularly every month, putting money in. Looking at mutual funds, how do you do it? What kind of account should I set up? Those types of things. So nothing that, again, this is not active. I'm talking about passive. Just buy into businesses and keep buying them and keep buying them. So then I get my license in 1996, retired from writing end of 96, became an advisor in 97. and they sent me to this broker training program. So from that point, I really had to learn the hard way what it was to get along. And I didn't realize all of the underhanded conflicts of interest that go on in the industry. The, for example, Wall Street firms have analysts that are paid to cover certain stocks and sectors. And when I was with Smith Barney, there was several analysts who were always putting out research pieces on certain companies. And I always believed them, hook, line, and sinker, thinking these guys know what they're doing. They're in insider knowledge, not inside, but they have firsthand knowledge of the company and recommending companies. And then following their advice and end up not doing well with it. And some of these companies actually went bankrupt, like WorldCom and Enron, who were both those companies, which were rated strong buy at the firm I was working at that time, Payne Weber. And you think, how can that happen? How can they miss that? How can that be possible? And the individual investor takes the blunt and the analyst just goes on as if nothing happened. You know, that's when I kind of disassociated with the Wall Street firms and I went on my own and, you know, custody all my assets with Raymond James. And now I have my own self to rely on. I do my own research on companies. I'm not going to listen to all these analysts per se and just buy what they say as if it's gospel. A lot of things going on like that, but making sure that people get started, number one, and then keep investing in good businesses. You know, we have our models that we run at my firm, investment models. So some of our stock only, so equity fund, equity models. And then we have mutual fund models and we have exchange traded fund models. You mentioned ETF. An advisor, one of the biggest roles is to keep people disciplined, on track, to map out a financial plan, to make sure that what they're doing makes sense. Because left to their own devices, when investors start dialing into their emotions and getting swept away with the media sensation or listening too much to Reddit boards, they can commit financial suicide by making terrible decisions. The Reddit, the GameStop, what was some of the other ones?
AMC.
Yes. I remember when they were so upset about not being able to buy enough shares. You know, this was the big controversy is why won't they let us buy more shares? They need to open up the trading blocks. And I put out a video and said, be careful what you wish for, guys, because all you folks that want to buy these stocks because that's the trend, the soup of the day type idea, you're going to lose it. You're going to lose all your money. There is no basis whatsoever for these stocks to be doing this. It was just a stupid trend. It was just psychological. And so that's what I worry about with some of these things that don't have any intrinsic value. I don't love gold because what is the intrinsic value other than you can use it for jewelry and maybe some industrial application? It doesn't pay your dividend. You could have all the gold in the world, pile it up in your room and ask, tell me what you're going to do with it. Are you going to chisel a chunk off and sell it and hope that somebody buys it from you? What if people just decide they don't want gold anymore? You don't have any real liquidity with it and you don't have any income stream with it. And that's why I'm not a big proponent of gold. I understand the reason for a defensive issue and for protecting against inflationary problems. And there's a whole nother can of worms we can go into with that, you know, with the government and what they've created here, this problem in our economy. But I don't know that owning something like gold, silver, all those. Hey, I know, Isaac, I know people who are they're so negative on anything to do with government and they're so terrified of everything falling apart that they, you know, not only do they have their bunkers, they have their gold or they have their, you know, metals, food storage, not saying any of that's wrong, but I'm saying when you put everything toward that, I think you've severely limited any potential financial freedom that you might ever otherwise experience.
I've got a friend who is very heavy, it's similar sentiment, right? He's very much anti-government. He's concerned that the US dollar is going to collapse. I've tried to have him convince me because he's like, no, you need to quit buying stocks. You need to buy gold. he even stocks up on rum. Like, he's like worried about the barter doomsday scenario.
But
like,
where's all the rum gone?
So I'm like, bro, if that happens, like, I'm dead. I don't even care. I don't want to live in that world anyway. But he points out some decent stuff. Like, he hears it from quasi conspiracy corners of, he's like, look, there's this BRICS. It's like kind of the evil version of the UN. You know, it's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and a bunch of these other sort of other countries, and they're coming together. And he's like, look, this BRICS thing, they're trying to tank the US dollar, and you know, you need to be prepared, you need to stock up on gold and all this stuff. And you know, I understand that, but me being, I'm a borderline doomsday prepper. I'm too lazy to actually do it, but I have the fear sometimes, and I'm like, man, I need to make sure I'm ready. And but then I think about it, I think, do I even, it's like you said, with if Costco, Home Depot, and all these other stocks collapse and go bankrupt, like, we got bigger issues, and I don't know if I'm cut to live in that kind of world anyway.
Yeah. No, but it's true.
But let's talk real quickly because I am curious about the current and short-term future state of affairs. You mentioned inflation, and me just kind of looking at stuff on the sidelines, I see, this is what I understand, you tell me where I'm wrong. The idea was inflation skyrocketed, you know, a year ago-ish, and they say it could have been for a variety of things, one of which was the government printed out an obscene amount of money for the pandemic response, and the current administration is driving the inflation down by raising the sort of base interest rate, and now it's kind of low and stable, and it's, I don't, from what I understood, was that's a good thing, and I imagine, I don't know, once we're past that crisis, stocks will come up again. I don't know. Like, what's the current state of affairs with all those things?
Gosh, we can get into so much here. I would love to shred a lot of the things with the Fed, because the Fed screwed up big time. I mean, I would say it. They missed every sign that inflation was going to be a problem. They sat there on their hands. And then they glad hand us and they tell us it's transitory. Go back in time if you want to listen to some of the press releases from this administration. Jen Psaki, remember, she was the press secretary. It's all transitory. Inflation's transitory. That was a crock of crap. And I knew it right back then. I knew it. I was telling everybody, guys, this is out of the bag. This is absolutely going to destroy the middle class and especially the lower class, lower income earners. When you have inflation kicking like that, it's a regressive tax. And you think about it, regressive means it hurts the lower end more, because they are the ones that suffer from not being unable to pay for goods and services and things that just normal people, everyday normal stuff that you have to live. And so they use this measure called CPI, Consumer Price Index. Well, isn't it convenient that back in like 1998, I believe, they changed the way that they report it. They changed the method that they use to calculate. It was the Congressional Budget Office refined the analysis, and they said, hey, we're going to adopt a different measure now, and we're going to remove used cars, we're going to remove food, and we're going to remove energy from CPI. So maybe the two most important things, possibly three most important things that people have to rely on to live their lives are removed from the CPI. Convenient, right? So now the government is sitting there telling us all that, you know, hey, inflation's down, you know, garbage. Real wages have gone up. So here's the thing. When they increase the money supply, and the money supply is controlled by the Federal Reserve. For those of you who don't know, the Federal Reserve was created in 1910 on Jekyll Island. All right, this is just a private, you know, rich man's club off of the state of Georgia. And Jekyll Island was where they formed, they got together these high-ranking officials, state officials, and also bankers, so J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers. They got together and decided, we're going to create a central bank, a federal institution that's going to control the money supply and set the interest rates for the country. Ultimately, it became a bailout package for big banks. You know, think about that. The conflict of interest there. These guys had the biggest banks in the country at that point, pretty much the world. So now you've got banks that can't fail, which, I mean, think about that. Just itself is a terrible idea, because now they can take on obscene amounts of risk, send out stupid loans, and there's no consequence. Guess who foots the bill for that? You and I, the taxpayers. So that's basically social risk with no private risk. Private gain at the expense of social risk. And now we go back and we have inflation. Inflation is a problem right now, and was created almost to help transition out of this massive debt that we're in. We have an unbelievable amount of debt, which is now approaching $34 trillion, maybe higher than $34 trillion as a country, with no real strategy on how we're going to get out of that. But they use inflation as a tool to service this massive amount of debt. Think about the purchasing power. So if you borrow money and then you have to pay it back at some point, but when you pay it back, you're paying it back with dollars that are worth less. You see what I mean? As a borrower. So the government is the biggest borrower in the world. Mm-hmm. And they have all this debt and that they've got on the books, but they're paying back the debt at less value to the people who own the debt, which is citizens like us. We're the ones that buy the bonds, the government bonds. That's where the government gets its money. And then when it prints new money, it has this new obligation. And it just decided during the pandemic, hell, we're going to shut everybody down. We're going to lock everybody up. We're going to make massive amount of fear over this thing, scare the hell out of everybody. And then, oh, we're going to keep the economy going. Not only are we going to shut down your job, but we're going to keep it going a little bit by printing 40% more money. Now think about that. If you had a rare collector's item and all of a sudden they added 40 more of them to the supply, 40%, you would have watered down value, right? Now there's more of them. So yours is not worth as much. That's inflation. That's how it works. And then to say that they were doing that as a necessary part of the solution, they created the problem and then told us that they've done a great job by taking care of us. This is where the lie gets overlooked and people just listen and they blindly trust what they're hearing in the news. You can't trust the news.
Are there people, when we talk about this stuff, when we say the Fed, right? Like the current chairman of the Federal Reserve is Jerome Powell.
Jerome Powell.
Is that the same people that are there for every administration, or does a new president appoint a new one?
Well, they can appoint new one once their term is up. Jerome Powell has been there since he was there during the last half of Trump's presidency, and then continued on with Biden.
So are these the people that, I mean, they talk about deep state stuff, right? They talk about this sort of Illuminati baked into the government and things. I mean, it seems like, I don't know, if the Federal Reserve is the one that we're looking to protect us from, you know, look out for, you know, because you say all this stuff and people like me, my eyes gloss over. I'm like, I have no idea, I guess. But I sleep at night because I think, well, you've got this Jerome Powell guy, the Fed or whatever, and they're supposed to look out for us because they don't want the U.S. to collapse either.
Right.
But then the things I'm hearing makes me feel like, or maybe they're orchestrating a squeeze of the middle class. And that ties into a lot of Great Reset conspiracy ideas, which I'm like, I kind of believe that's what they want.
I am much more cynical than I've ever been in my life. That started during the pandemic. My eyes were open wider than I ever thought I would be possible for me, because I'm usually kind of go with the flow. Hey, this is the way things are. But when I saw what they did, and then I saw how they twisted the narrative and changed the story on everything that I knew to be true. And then tell us that they did it for our benefit. And they're still telling us that. And so many people are buying that and believing in that. And then they just disrupt the story about, where did that thing come from? Mm-hmm. How come we can't get an answer on that? Why are we as citizens just like allowing that to be case closed? That is a crock of crap right there.
Right.
That thing, if you want to get into conspiracies, that thing was manufactured. And they're starting to become more and more evidence showing that. But why won't they let that come out? this is where you start to know that governments, and this is through history, by the way, governments, as a general rule, are corrupt. They want the power. They want to protect the people at the top, and they want to control everyone else. So the masses have to rely on everything. You go back to, I don't care, the days of the Roman Empire. It doesn't matter. It's the same concept until finally there's an uprising. Revolution, French Revolution, American Revolution. That's when you finally topple a government and start the whole thing over again. I'm not suggesting that's what we're going to do here. We have a great country. But to think that they are doing everything for the benefit of us and doing everything all correctly and innocently, that's a very naive way to look at things. I think that the Fed is very much political, very much corrupt in a lot of ways. They are manufacturing the way they want the economy to look, a lot of times for political point, for keeping things going good and leading up to an election. And then we'll deal with it, you know, during the next 4 years, just make sure we get the elections tied up. You know, much more going on than people want to look at. I mean, most people don't want to have to deal with these things day in and day out. And I don't either. It'd be really nice to think that, hey, our government set up the way it was intended by the founding fathers for the people. But it's far from that at this point.
Interesting. I'm watching the clock. I know I got to let you go here soon. Real quick, any for people out there who are kind of the sort of solo investor type folks, that which includes me. I do that sometimes, and it's a lot to maintain and watch. That's why I like going through a service like yours, where I just, I'm like, you guys look at this, you figure it out. Because I read that Peter Lynch book, and I started doing. I have a spreadsheet where I look at the business financials, and then every quarter you got to sort of, you know, make sure it's still on the up and up or whatever. Are there any specific, I don't know, like sectors or businesses that you would say, you know, you're interested in or kind of look like they're of interest?
One thing I learned from Peter Lynch is buy what you know. And the best way to apply that is to look around when you're out in public or shopping, going to a store, or seeing things that you buy. I a lot of times use my wife's shopping habits as a potential investment ideas, because she started, you know, women do a lot of things together and they get trendy, and they were doing all these purses a few years ago. And I'm like, what the heck is this? And they're buying these purses, and I'm like, what that company? And so we started looking into that. We actually added this company to our portfolio. Now about 3-4 years ago, all right, now we're starting to see boxes come to the house and packages come from Lululemon. And I'm like, wait a minute, what's this company? So I started looking into that, and that became an investment. That became part of our portfolio. I mean, I don't know if you ever shopped there, Isaac, but that store is crazy busy, and they make very high quality clothing, and people pay top dollar for it. And the trend are really, really good. Now, how does that affect if we go into a recession or the economy slows down? Time will tell. I'm not suggesting all these things make sense for every single person listening, but that's how I start looking at for investment ideas. And I also look at trends in the economy. I look at management. I look at people who are running the company. Are they competent? Do they know what they're doing? Are they staying ahead of the curve? So I look at Elon Musk, for example, and I'm not advocating for all the things that he's doing necessarily, but I think the guy is very, very smart. And we've had Tesla in our models for a number of years, and I think it's getting very interesting at this price. He's had the company sold off maybe 20, 30, 40% even from maybe the high. I think it's getting very interesting at this price right now. I've always liked Costco. I mean, just go try to find a parking spot there.
Right.
It's one of the quick tells on a good investment story. Now, right now in sectors, we are moving and shifting more to the more traditional oil and gas, traditional energy kind of companies and industrial type companies, because I want some stability, companies that pay a dividend. I do feel like there's going to be a recession at some point here in the next maybe 12 to 18 months. It's been telling us that. The inverted yield curve has been telling us that for almost 2 years now, with that kind of money supply that we've printed. I'm not saying anything drastic, but some of these valuations need to come down anyway. There are places that you need to kind of reposition a portfolio. Don't get sucked into the idea that you need to go to all the cash, though. Not a good idea. just use this as an opportunity to continue to acquire as things move forward. Get a pullback, keep buying more shares. Good businesses are where the real returns come from.
Tell me about your second book, your new book. I haven't seen it yet. I think you're close to publishing this thing. It's called From the Starting Gate, Winning Strategies for Wealth, Health, and Happiness. What's going to be in the second book?
Tons of stories, a lot more stories than in the first. You know, I wrote the book, Harnessing Wealth, on wealth, creating wealth, because I really wanted to share what I had learned in my life and how the concepts, if you follow them, they're not rocket science. It's just easy, simple steps. And I speak in language that people can understand. And that's what all the feedback that I got from the book, which is a lot. Everyone's told me how much they appreciate how I make it easy. And then in this book, I just wanted to elaborate on all I've learned about health and the faulty medical advice that we're all getting in our society today. And, you know, the medical industry has become a behemoth, and they are controlling the way we perceive our own bodies, and they've separated the mind and the body. And that should never have happened. Mind and the body are one. The mind controls everything. Every kind of disease starts and ends in the mind. If you just understand how it happens, then you know that you created it yourself, and you can also end it. You can also get out of it. I learned that the hard way. I have a lot of experience, and I have a lot of stories, both personal as well as third-party stories from tons of other people. My wife and I are huge advocates of healing and helping yourself rather than always wanting to run to a pharmacy or to get a pill or a surgery. So many of those things are becoming exposed as not really working. The health epidemic is not getting better. And you'd think it would be with all this, the money we're spending, not getting better. We're all getting worse.
And I love how we've come full circle to the beginning when I was saying that it seemed like health and finances were two gateways into the conspiracy theory mindset, which, you know, and we talked about this during the pandemic. A lot of those are the exact topics that came up and we're dealing with to this day is health and finances. And those are kind of the big questions and the big topics that we all try to get a little bit more exposure on. So I'm looking forward to reading that second book of yours. Now, in the meantime, where can the audience connect with you, your podcast, and where's a great place they can get the books?
Sure. Thanks. So Harnessing Your Wealth, just look that up on any platform that you like to stream your podcast, Harnessing Your Wealth. And also, if you can follow my company, we have a website, and then we have a lot of good information. We send out videos on, we have YouTube channel, Peterson Wealth Services. Look that up and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you follow us, then you'll know, and I'll be posting when my book is going to be published. Right now, I am with Balboa Press and working on a deal with Hay House to publish the book. I'm very excited about it. And, you know, there's a couple other books in history. Napoleon Hill wrote one called The Law of Success almost 100 years ago. And he covered the same three topics, health, wealth, and happiness. It was his take on how to achieve those things. That was an international bestseller. Now, Joseph Murray talks a lot about subconscious mind and the power of subconscious mind and all of those key areas as well. His book was published in the 1960s called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. You know, those books are just, they stand the test of time. And we get away from that too often because we start going into this thing of, I want it quicker. You know, I want to snap my fingers. But this is the way that we have to get back to what we know to be true, innately true. And it's not in a pill, and it's not in a click of a button or in a token. It's something that we do that we know that we can bring to our manifest into our lives. And that's what I think everyone's going to appreciate with my book and my take with my stories, my life as a jockey and my life as a financial advisor.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. You really are an inspiration, man. So I appreciate that you're willing to get on our show and talk to us about some of these things. And you really do. The books, they do read very well, and it's not very confusing. And, you know, it's a real good place for someone to get some good information on investing. So thank you for your time, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Isaac.
All right. I hope that shed some light on the ideas of finances. But if you want more, if you want to learn more about investing and how to do this and when to talk to the experts, check out his podcast. You really got to check it out. It's really good. I subscribe to it. It's called Harnessing Your Wealth. And I'll put the links in the show notes. Go subscribe. Like I said, I was on there in February to talk about conspiracy stuff with him, and that was a good time. But he's got tons of shows on there with great guests and experts. But he drops tons of great free information and advice on investing, not these grifter types you see on Instagram trying so hard to convince you that you need to buy their course because they're the expert. And like, they never even learned about this stuff. They don't know what they're doing. This guy, Billy Knowles, right? These grifters, they spend more time trying to convince you on the illusion that they're these successful entrepreneurs, and it's all fake news. But Billy's the real deal. And his first book is on Amazon. It's called Harnessing Your Wealth, The Pursuit of Millionaire Status by Billy Peterson. I'll put the link in the show notes. The second one's on the way. And that first book, we didn't talk about it, but what's really fascinating is his experience as a jockey. He talks about how he would win these championships, and everyone would go out to eat and drink afterwards, and this poor guy had to eat like cabbage soup while everyone's eating and drinking, having a good time, like, whoa, good job, Billy. And he couldn't eat because he's got to make weigh-in on the next race. Like, man, I mean, that's a tough, you can't be weak and do a jockey. I know that much. I learned that much. But anyways, check out all of his stuff. Subscribe to his podcast. Till next time, stay positive.